Huitzil approachedly slew joyously. Sword whirling through armor and flesh as if through the air, he waded through a final knot of defenders and stepped gingerly into the festive hall across shards of armaglass blown in by RPGs. A knight of the Quetzal charged him, shield up and sword raised. White teeth glared from a black-painted face in a fearsome grin.
Die, monster!
Huitzilopochtli swept his sword transversely down, right to left. The black glass shard hit the knight's forearm midway up from his sword hand. His hand jumped free on a spume of scarlet. Huitzilopochtli's flat backhand struck the man at the level of his eyes. The whole top of his head was sliced off. Half decapitated, the body hurtled past and fell outside into the watery light. Huitzilopochtli trembled in ecstasy as he imbibed the man's life force. There was something about doing it in the hot blood of combat, something about triumphing, dominating, destroying, that made it all the sweeter and the keener. Mere sacrifice could not compare. A brave man, Huitzilopochtli thought, worthy of his flowery sacrifice. He flicked his brawny wrist to clear his sword of gore and clots of brain. Stalking through the now abandoned commissary with the hot blood of the hunt practically boiling in his veins, Huitzilopochtli cursed his brother for a coward for demurring from this raid. Tezcatlipoca's jaguar knights had not been conspicuous in the hottest fighting these past few days either. Huitzilopochtli's own eagle knights had been more than happy to grab for the glory, as had their divine master. But now, it came to Huitzilopochtli that the cunning Tezcatlipoca might be scheming against him, hoping Huitzilopochtli and Quetzalcoatl would exhaust their resources battling each other, leaving the survivor, who naturally would be Huitzilopochtli, weakened and vulnerable. He felt a tingling sensation at his left hip. Scowling, he stopped and reached into the pouch of cured human hide that rode there, coming up with a polished disc of obsidian just larger than the palm of his hand.
Yes.
Coatlicue's face appeared in the mirror. Her jade eyes were wide.
My son, you must return at once. Talokan is under attack. The interloper Tonatia stands upon the top of the pyramid, challenging you before the cameras of our own news service.
Fury surged within the war god. The insolence. How dare they do to him what he was so incisively doing to them?
I'll come as soon as I can gather my forces.
No, there is no time. You must come at once and face this foreigner alone, or all we have worked for is lost.
He wanted to argue, but found himself peering at a blank planchet of glass. Grinding his teeth in rage, he thrust the now quiescent mirror back into its pouch and turned to his escorts.
Get me a helicopter, now!
Down in the pyramid, the well-shaped hand of Coatlicue, which even in the flush of her first youth, when she had been known and well-feared as Felicidad Mendoza, had been feminine, yet strong as many men's, descended, holding the mirror. But as it reached the bottom of the arm's arc, it became a wire-muscled, dark-skinned, very masculine hand. Attached to the other end of that arm, Tezcatlipoca, the shape-changing god, smiled.
Choppers inbound!
The entry door to the pyramid's depths blew outward like a cork from a bottle. The door had missed the two Quetzalcoatl knights on guard when it flew out and over the black altar to bounce down the stairs. They raised their plasma rifles. The wail stopped, only to blast forth again. The knights' screams mingled with the terrifying sound as blood squirted from their ears. Then they were shattered into nothingness as if by a high-velocity blast wave. Bridget grabbed Lakesh by his aspect's brawny upper biceps and whirled him out of the tiny pavilion.
Find cover! I'll handle this!
Why, certainly it's wise of you to preserve my own wisdom for future service to our shared dream of reuniting—
Go!
She whirled to face the figure in the doorway.
So you're the Bolia bitch they picked to be the new Chalchihuitlicue.
And you are Felicidad Mendoza. Rather well preserved for a woman your age.
Kane looked up as three large black shapes had appeared in the air, streaking like arrows for the pyramid. A ruby beam cracked over his head. The top 2 inches of the tallest feather of his helmet were snipped off and floated down before his face like a leaf. A second beam pulsed at once. The lead ship's nose came up and it drifted to the level of the following two, which had been stepped above it. Then it banked to starboard, and the disc of its main rotor intersected with that of the right-hand wingman. Both instantly shattered into sprays of black splinters. The two gunships, now basically fast-moving bricks, descended into the fog. A fractional second later, two balls of flame sprouted through the thick white blanket and rolled upward on stalks of black smoke.
Whoa! Yeah! Two for the price of one! I meant to do that.
Smoke puffed beneath the left-hand element's starboard stub wing.
Missile launch!
A big anti-tank guided missile with a hefty shaped charge warhead spiraled toward the altar, drawing a corkscrew of smoke. Kane threw up his sword and loosed a solar flare. It missed.
Everybody, get behind me!
He summoned forth the energy of the burning geomagnetic lines, dumped it into the sun shield, raised the blazing disc before him. The missile struck. Emerald eyes met eyes of jade and locked. Two beautiful red-headed women. One with hair like the slow-motion fall of Hawaiian lava, the other, whose hair resembled fine copper wire, stared at each other with pure essence of rage. If looks could kill, they'd cancel each other out, apparently.
Your death case is stronger than I would have thought. The traitor Marroquin chose well, it seems.
Well, you're giving me a hell of a headache.
Enough female bonding down there! Bridget, duck!
Bridget crouched and turned from sheerest reflex. Flame and shockwaves fanned outward, safely missing Tenatio and his comrades. The surviving chopper's gunner might have been stunned by his mighty rocket's spectacular non-effect. He did not do the obvious thing and sweep the pyramid's apex with his chin gun, as Tonja had. He did nothing at all as his pilot let the chopper's momentum carry it forward right over the giant structure. As it did, Grant whipped up his plasma rifle and blasted the aircraft in the belly. The hurtling gunship began to come apart around the expanding yellow glare, right in the direction of Domi, still perched on top of the pyramid.
Fuck!
She dove for cover right before the helicopter swept beyond her and blew up.
Cutting that pretty close, weren't you?
It worked, didn't it?
Bridget's in trouble!
Bridget heard what sounded like a scream behind her, but she knew that Coatlicue was not crying out in terror. A wave of sound smashed into her like a wag. Something twisted her body from within, trying to tear each and every molecule in her body away from the others. She turned and straightened. Her headdress was ripped from her head. Her hair streamed out behind her like rocket exhaust. The light cloth she had wrapped around her breasts disintegrated. But investiture with the self-perpetuating energy pattern known as Chalchihuitlicue had given Bridget superhuman strength and durability, as it had her companions. But it had its limits. Her eyes stung and watered. Her lungs could not suck in air no matter how she strained. She couldn't long withstand Coatlicue's murder scream. Nor could she draw sufficient moisture down from the clouds nor up from the lake deep beneath the city to use as a weapon against the other goddess. Too much energy and concentration were required literally to hold herself together. But Bridget was Bridget, as well as Chalchihuitlicue. Her greatest strength was still her mind. She had an idea. What if she could direct the water inside her enemy? She saw a chance and reached out with the power of her demon rider. Coatlicue's eyes snapped open. Then they shriveled within the orbits of her skull. Her eyelids caved in, then tautened, turning the consistency of parchment. The fingers of Coatlicue's raised hands began to diminish and wrinkle like raisins. Her full breasts withered, as did her arms and thighs. But her belly was swelling. Swelling, not just to the front, but outward in all directions, like a balloon being pumped full of water, which burst. Water exploded in all directions. The mother of the gods collapsed into a pile of dehydrated tissue stretched over skull and bones.
Quick thinking, Baptiste.
Bridget turned, smiled faintly, and brushed at a lock of hair that had fallen into her eyes. She tottered toward the altar.
I need to sit down.
Not there, Bridget. You don't want any goddess pieces on you.
Bridget nodded and slumped down to the platform. Domi turned her face to the sky.
You think Huitzilopochtli was in one of those death birds we just wasted?
We aren't that lucky.
Quetzalcoatl stepped around the corner of the stone pavilion built over the now open entrance.
You have all performed brilliantly, but my new associate assures me that Huitzilopochtli will unquestionably take up Tonatio's challenge.
He's sure gonna be pissed when he sees what you did to his mom.
Quetzalcoatl knelt beside Chalchihuitlicue.
Bridget, Darling Bridget, are you all right?
She raised her head. He recoiled. Her eyes were like bezels of blood in which were set emerald irises.
I'm afraid more of her force got through than I thought, Lakesh. I'm afraid I might be hemorrhaging.
Blood gushed from her mouth. Her head fell to the side.
Baptiste!
Kane lunged toward her. Grant interposed himself.
You can't help her, Kane. Let the man do his thing.
Donatio glared in fury at the mortal who had presumed to interfere with him.
Back off the trigger here, big guy. It's me, your partner. Grant, remember?
With a spasm of will, Kane asserted himself over his demon riders. He nodded with difficulty.
You're right.
But his Anamkara lay on her back as if lifeless, blood streaming from her nose, ears, and mouth. It ran like tears from her eyes, which stared without blinking at the ceiling of cloud, which seemed to be breaking up.
Hey guys, look up!
The distance-muted rotor chop of a helicopter hidden in the clouds reached their ears. A black dot had appeared below the clouds. It rapidly grew larger, taking on the shape of a man with splayed-out limbs. The figure rolled into a ball, then, at the instant before impact, straightened with its feet below it. It hit the top of the black altar. The black granite slab split straight across with a cannon-shot crack and a golden flash. Huitzilopochtli straightened, great muscled legs straddling the split, grinning malevolently down from his black-painted face. He wore a skirt of gold plates, a golden helmet with a high side-to-side crest, flat sandals laced high up his shins. He carried a shield and sword similar to Tonatio's, with his symbol painted on the front of his buckler.
So you thought to challenge the primary god of war? Yes, I speak English out of regard to your gringo ears. My mother, the goddess Coatlicue, taught me. And where is she?
That's her. Her moisturizer broke down on her.
Tactful, Grant.
Never said I was a diplomat.
I shall take your hearts and burn them as a sacrifice to my mother Coatlicue. Except for you, Tonatia. When I have done with you, there shall be but one sun god remaining, and it shall be the god of war!
Let's all jump him at once, but he can't take us all.
No good. If I welch on the challenge, the whole populace turns against Quetzalcoatl, which means all of us. And even if we got away with our skins, you're the only one who'd still be alive come sunup tomorrow. All right, you get your chance to make good your boast, left-hand hummingbird. But if I win, it's over. Quetzalcoatl will be restored to his full place.
Huitzilopochtli's face seemed carved of stone as he glowered down upon his rival. Then it cracked in a brutal smile.
My brother, who fears to show his face even now, would probably make his peace with you quickly enough were you to defeat me. But that will never happen. Prepare!
Everybody, off. Give us room here.
Lakesh, still in his Quetzalcoatl aspect, stood up, bearing Bridget's limp body in his arms. He strode to the side of the platform and hopped down to the next step of the pyramid. Kane set his jaw. Grant was right. He could do nothing for her but beat Huitzilopochtli and hope. Eyes wide in bloodless faces, the remaining knights backed away and clambered down. Grant laid his hand on Kane's shoulder, where it was left bare by his breastplate, squeezed once hard, then turned and climbed down to the next level himself. Kane's companions could just see over the platform's edge. Domi pulled herself up to sit cross-legged on her roof, still in Itzapapalotl form.
Good luck, Kane.
Huitzilopochtli jumped down to stand facing Kane across the broken black altar. He bared his teeth.
Are you ready, Tonatia?
I am.
Then we begin.
Instead of bringing his sword into play, Kane stretched his arm toward the war god and flexed his wrist. His sin-eater pounded into his hand and erupted in a yard-long muzzle flame and a loud, ripping snarl. Huitzilopochtli rocked his weight back slightly on his heels as bullets hit him full in the center of his bare, great-muscled chest. The slide locked back on an empty box. The silence was startling.
What do you play at, sun god? You must know I am enveloped by a field of invincibility. Your foolish bullets barely tickled.
Try another magazine.
My patience wears thin, gringo.
Kane let the weapon snap back into the holster strapped to his forearm.
Then see how you like this.
Kane drew his sword, straightened his arm toward Huitzilopochtli, and sent his solar flare leaping forth. Huitzilopochtli just got his own shield interposed as Tonatio launched his bolt. Superheated plasma surrounded him in a brilliant nimbus. The Watchers, knowing how the solar flare drained Donatio's energy, expected the beam to wink out. It did not, nor did it penetrate Huitzilopochtli's own personal form-fitting force screen. The war god leaned forward and began to stride into the beam, leaning as if he were forcing his way against the blast of a hose. Step by step, he waded up the roaring jet. The hard stone of the platform melted and ran before and beneath his sandaled feet as he came forward.
Kane, what the hell do you think you're doing?
The flare flickered once, twice, then went out. Kane staggered, caught himself.
Drained your batteries, did you, sun god?
Slowly, a smile stretched itself above Kane's vertical bar of beard.
Pretty much. And yours too, I bet.
His sword whipped in a backhand stroke for Huitzilopochtli's muscle wedge of a neck. Inhumanly fast as he was, the war god barely managed to lean back out of harm's way as the obsidian blade sang past. Huitzilopochtli straightened. Tonatio stepped back. The war god smiled. Then his heavy, handsome, black-painted features crumpled into a frown. He let his own volcanic glass sword hang from its thong, raised his hand to his left cheek, touched it lightly. When he dropped his hand, the fingertips glistened with red wetness.
Looks like we got us a little more level playing field here. No projectile webs, no magic shields. Just us, mano a mano.
That's mano a mano, you ignorant prick!
Huitzilopochtli launched a ferocious overhead swing. Kane stopped it with his shield. The impact flung him back 5 yards through the air. He sat down hard on the very rim of the platform. Huitzilopochtli rushed him. Kane leaped aside and up, getting his feet beneath him and aiming a cut at Huitzilopochtli's unprotected right side. But Huitzilopochtli was supernaturally good as well as fast. Before he either took the cut or rushed headlong off the top of the pyramid, he whirled aside, went to one knee.
Well done. Not good enough, but better than I thought you'd do.
You too.
The two men crab-stepped cautiously back toward the broken altar, away from the edge. When they neared the stone slab, Huitzilopochtli launched a furious attack. As blows rained on his shield, Kane soon realized the war god was faster, stronger, and better than he was. It wasn't a heartening combination. They drew apart. Kane was panting like a locomotive, but gratified to see his adversary breathing through an open mouth as well. His Tonatio persona and Don Pedro yammered like a flock of magpies in Kane's skull. He did his best to ignore them. They weren't war gods either. If this deadly duel was going to be won, it would be won by Kane, which meant mag rules, which brought it all into focus. He began to circle to his right, a few sideways steps, being careful not to cross his feet, which would have drawn a charge and at the very least would have made him trip over himself and go down, brought the altar between them.
Clever. But do you really think that will keep my blades from finding your flesh?
Possibly not, but Kane thought it might keep him from being knocked down by a charge. Huitzilopochtli leaped up onto the altar, hacking down at Kane's head. Kane flung his shield up in time, crouched, and swung for the war god's ankles. Huitzilopochtli leaped over the blow. As Kane cocked his sword back for a follow-up shot, Huitzilopochtli touched down and slashed back. Kane felt a sting along his right forearm. He jumped back. He looked to see a thin line of blood drawn transversely across his arm, just beginning to bead and run. Huitzilopochtli jumped down on Kane's side of the altar. They exchanged a quick series of blows, at the end of which, Kane was bleeding from a slash across the bridge of his nose that burned as if Huitzilopochtli's blades had been dipped in acid. Time was not on his side. The trickle of blood running down his left arm reminded him of the fact. It was time to take a serious gamble. He feinted at Huitzilopochtli's head to bring the war god's guard up. Their shields clashed together. Kane thrust with all the strength of his legs and back. Huitzilopochtli pushed back. For a moment, they glared at each other, sweating and straining over their shield rims. Inevitably, Huitzilopochtli's greater strength began to tell. He sprang back. With his superb training and godlike reflexes, the war god didn't seriously stumble, nor was he open long. He caught himself in time to throw his upper body back out of harm's way. Had he been able to gut the big son of a bitch then and there, Kane would not have complained. Instead, as intended, his black glass blades kissed the leather shield strap inside Huitzilopochtli's left forearm. It only nicked the smooth brown skin, but the strap parted, causing the shield to come loose. He threw it spinning away, then seized the haft of his sword with both hands and launched his most furious attack yet. Great smashing, sweeping blows that flurried in with impossible speed. Kane gave way step by step. There was no thought of attacking now. It took everything he had just to keep his own shield between that howling, glass-edged sword and his tender flesh. Vitala Pochli landed a stroke full force and fully perpendicular to the plane of Kane's shield. Metal-sheathed, polycarbonate or not, the shield split right in two. Only by luck and the fact that he was already backing up half a step was Kane saved from having his arm severed or shattered by the blow. As it was, his left forearm was numbed, and his right heel fetched up against the side of the stone pavilion. Huitzilopochtli aimed a shot from over his shoulder that might cleave even a god from crown to navel. Kane ducked right. Huitzilopochtli embedded his sword in the stone of the door jamb. Without hesitation, Kane launched himself into Huitzilopochtli's midriff in a clumsy but fierce tackle. Stuck tight, the glass-bladed sword was wrenched from Huitzilopochtli's hand as the war god was driven onto his back with Kane full length atop him. Kane brought up his legs, trying to get on his knees with his thighs around Huitzilopochtli's waist. Stronger though the war god was, he was nowhere near strong enough to throw Kane off from the classic mount position. As Kane leaned forward, Huitzilopochtli headbutted him. Their helmets clashed. Again, polycarbonate gave way to superhuman strength. Both gilded helmets split. With a heave of his whole body, Huitzilopochtli threw Kane off him. The thong around Kane's right wrist broke, leaving the sword behind. Huitzilopochtli jackknifed to his feet, but facing away from his opponent. By the time he turned, Kane was on his feet, wiping blood from his cut nose with the back of his hand. They stood facing each other, Huitzilopochtli a great raging tiger without stripes, Kane a lean gray wolf. Huitzilopochtli attacked with a wild looping right to the head that was almost a haymaker. Kane ducked, then stepped into him with his left leg, driving a right cross to his midsection, and following it at once with a brutal hook to the short ribs. Huitzilopochtli glided back. His lips were closed, but still smiling. Fists raised, he came on. I'm the better boxer, Kane thought, but the war god was probably more experienced with wrestling. It went right with the whole Mexican masked wrestler motif Bridget had told him about, which meant he was at least prepared when Huitzilopochtli lunged. He thought the war god might dive low for a takedown and readied the classic riposte, which was basically to stay fairly upright and just push him face first into the stone platform by the shoulders. Instead, Huitzilopochtli just put his head down, meaning he got his weight lower than Kane's by the time they hit, which meant he instantly drove Kane bicycling backwards. Kane grabbed both gigantic biceps, sat down a little too hard, saw stars as his tailbone slammed. Then he rolled back, put a sandal into Huitzilopochtli's flat gut, and threw him into the side of the stairway housing. The war god recovered far quicker than Kane imagined possible. The haft of his own sword jutted temptingly near to hand, but Huitzilopochtli was too canny to squander an opportunity trying to jimmy it loose. He rushed Kane, storming punches into his head and face as the other god got to one knee. Kane went into a turtle, bringing up both forearms to try to block the sledgehammer hits. Huitzilopochtli raised his right hand high overhead, prepping a hammer fist blow that would either stave in the back of Kane's head or snap his neck. Kane took advantage of the lull to push out a not very potent straight right punch. Not very potent, but it hit Huitzilopochtli's exposed solar plexus. The war god backpedaled. Kane had bought the space he needed to get his legs under him again, and did. His right eye was sealed, not by a direct hit, but by a cut opened in the brow above. Blood was pouring into the socket and already starting to congeal there, effectively gluing his lid shut. Kane lacked time even to try to wipe it clear because Huitzilopochtli was on him again. Kane struck twice wildly, felt his fists strike. Then Huitzilopochtli had him by the upper arms. Kane returned the favor. This time Kane's center of gravity was lower, giving him better leverage to resist the war god's pushing. But rather than trying to drive him back, Huitzilopochtli let his arms flex slightly, then shoved upward. Kane's center of gravity stayed low, but his head rose. His clear eye met both of Huitzilopochtli's. It was like an ice pick stabbed through to his brain. A black explosion filled Kane's skull. Pain shot straight down his spine and arms. Tonatiuh saved him then. It was the real sun god, not Kane, who in less than an eye blink sought and found the fiery lines. Perhaps it helped that at that instant the sun broke through beneath the overcast and sent red rays slanting across pyramid and plaza. Kane's energy had been drained away in draining Huitzilopochtli's, and he had no chance to recharge. But the sun god knew his own powers well and stopped the blackness from overwhelming Kane. He could see, fuzzily, The war god's eyes were flashed and mad.
I too have a death gaze, sun god. Now I drink your life, accept your flowery sacrifice to myself, and next I will claim your friends' lives.
Kane's skull throbbed as if his brain were swelling. He couldn't resist the gaze much longer. Tonatio wailed within his mind.
That's okay, because where gods fail, mags prevail.
He brought his right knee up hard into Huitzilopochtli's balls. Huitzilopochtli doubled over in all-too-human fashion into a brutal punch that was more shovel hook than uppercut from Kane's god-hard fist against Huitzilopochtli's broad chin. Huitzilopochtli's head snapped back. Kane raised his right leg, turned his hip over, and pistoned a thrusting sidekick into Huitzilopochtli's midsection. The war god staggered back, gagging. Kane snatched up his dropped sword and planted it smack in the center of Huitzilopochtli's chest. Kane wrenched the weapon from the war god's chest and threw it away. Then, with hands back to back, he plunged his fingers into the red wound gaping like a vertical mouth in Huitzilopochtli's chest and shoved him back until the backs of his legs struck the altar. Then he bore the war god down upon his own altar and pried open Huitzilopochtli's ribcage with his own bare hands. He reached into the now cavernous yawn of the stricken god's chest and wrapped his hand around his heart. It continued to beat strongly. He smiled then and prepared to wrench it from Huitzilopochtli's chest.
Stop!
Kane froze. Such was his rage that he thought no force on earth could keep him from carrying out his vengeance vow. He was wrong. The voice of a dead man could. Still gripping the heart, Kane looked over his shoulder. Dr. Marroquin stood a few paces behind.
How the hell did you get here?
Marroquin held up his hand. The disc of his miniature smoking mirror flashed a reflection of the sun's rays.
The same way I escaped from the streaking helicopter. This very useful device also allows me to teleport, rather in the manner of Dr. Lakesh's clever interfacers. Now please, Lord Tonatiuh, friend Kane, let go. Do not slay Huitzilopochtli.
Why not?
It would disrupt the order of things within the valley too greatly. We have our victory. The power of the two is broken. They can no longer resist Quetzalcoatl's return. Not now, when all Tenochtitlan has seen how you have bested the war god, and even claimed his heart.
But it's mine, and I do claim it.
The fury had begun to ebb within him. At the same time, he neither knew whether it was Kane who said that, or Tonatiuh, nor did he care.
Please.
Marroquin's face looked more than grave.
He's right, Kane. We've won, my friend. Your victory is immaculate.
Huitzilopochtli was fully unconscious now. The beating of his heart seemed to weaken.
What about Tezcatlipoca? What do you think he'll say?
I believe I can assure you he will assent.
And what makes you think that?
Kane!
Kane turned. He let go of his victim's heart.
Baptiste?
Brigid Baptiste stood beside Quetzalcoatl on the step down from the platform.
Lakesh healed me. Quetzalcoatl, I'm fine now, if just a little shaky.
Let me take him. Please.
What makes you think you can carry him?
The same thing that makes him so sure Tezcatlipoca will agree to terms. That's not Marroquin, Kane.
Oh, I'm Marroquin, all right, Lady Precious Green. At least, I'm the only Marroquin you've known.
The contours Kane associated with Dr. Marroquin blurred, flowed, and grew taller. Then a dark-skinned man a little shorter than he was stood facing him, clad in a loincloth. He was leanly muscled and handsome in a hawk-like way.
I am Tezcatlipoca, as your astute Miss Baptiste divined. And now, as God to God, I beg your mercy for my brother.
How about mercy for you, since you seem to be the ranking bad guy right about now?
As I have said, I am the one you believed was Marroquin. I brought you here and changed the four of you. You have given me what I want, and if you will allow me to see to Huitzilopochtli, I will see that you receive all that I have promised you.
Why should we trust you?
If you will consult your colleague's eidetic memory, you will learn that I am also a god of justice. In various guises, I tempt men to do ill, and then punish them if they do so, or reward them if they behave virtuously. A distasteful pastime to you, perhaps, but Lady Chochi Wheatliquay will attest that my adherence to justice is scrupulous.
That is what the legend says. And down here, anyway, the legends all seem to be true.
All right. He's all yours.
Tezcatlipoca walked past him with an unselfconsciously regal bearing, utterly unlike Marroquin's. Tezcatlipoca took up Huitzilopochtli in his sinewy arms, turned his face upon the setting sun, and bore his stricken brother down into the pyramid from which they had jointly ruled Tenochtitlan. It was night in the conversation space high up in the Institute's main building. The afternoon's battle had not touched it. The buffet had been replenished, but only Domi was able to eat. The others slumped on chairs and sofas and tried to stay awake. Tezcatlipoca was back in the guise of Marroquin.
The original Dr. Marroquin suffered an unfortunate accident while experimenting in the Black House sometime prior to his apparent defection. Such were the levels and nature of the energies involved that his body was instantly and tracelessly disintegrated. Only by exhaustive analysis of sensor readings from the lab was I able to discover that much. As it happened, I found it convenient that the good doctor should carry on, or be seen to. So I employed my shape-changing skills, along with some old-fashioned stage magic and the odd falsification of records.
An accident.
I won't insult your intelligence by attempting to convince you that I would be incapable of arranging for the violent dissociation of the poor doctor's component atoms. I've done much worse. Let it pass. It's only barely relevant.
Teresa and Ernesto were present as well. They sat side by side on one of the couches. The young hybrid woman stared at her father in the guise of the man she had come to think of as a father, with an admixture of fascination and loathing.
I'm curious. The artifact in the basement, is it...
A very good replica of the true and original smoking mirror, capable of most but not all of its functions. But not even I have been able to plumb all of the genuine article's mysteries.
What makes you think your, this Huitzilopochtli character will abide by the new arrangement?
Fait accompli, mostly. All of Tenochtitlan saw him fall to the hand of Tenatiuh. Or Tenochtitlan saw Tezcatlipoca and Quetzalcoatl mount the top of the Pyramid of the Gods, side by side, to announce the restoration of the Triumvirate. Even with his powers of recuperation, even with the restorative power of the life vats, Huitzilopochtli will be many days recovering from his injuries. The new order will be firmly in place by then.
He sipped from a mug of chocolatl.
And also because of our mother's death. You need feel no concern, Miss Baptiste. I shall mourn my mother in my own way and in my own time. I loved her, but I bear you no animus for killing her. It was a necessary outcome, one I contrived. Huitzilopochtli is the weaker-willed of the two of us. He was too susceptible to Coatlicue's sway. It was she who truly became addicted to sacrifice, that is, to ever more and greater mass sacrifices. She encouraged that addiction in my brother, in both of us. It is not easy to resist, as those of you who bear Tenochtitlan, Chachihuitlicue, and Itzapapalotl can attest, from having drunk in lives in battle. But I successfully resisted it.
You've taken many lives in sacrifice!
He held up a hand.
Peace, it is true. I do not deny taking sacrifices. I do deny that my appetite for them became a need as overwhelming as it did for Huitzilopochtli and Coatlicue. Along with his blood addiction, our mother encouraged my brother in his incipient megalomania. After we drove Quetzalcoatl out 30 years ago, they began to aggrandize themselves, not just at my expense, but that of Tenochtitlan's economy and the stability of the whole valley, as the other city-states began to groan under their exactions. Which was why, some 2 years ago, I decided balance must be restored, which meant Quetzalcoatl must be returned to share power. And so I set in motion the events that culminated here this day.
He set down his mug.
And so, my guests, you will be restored to your former estates, as promised. You must spend one final night in the vats. Your own exertions have weakened you too greatly to survive the change without recovery.
Cain looked to Brigid. They shuddered.
What will you do for a Quetzalcoatl?
We will find an appropriate candidate. We have some short period of grace, during which the plumed serpent can be said to be closeted for meditation, or even tending to the healing of his great foe, Huitzilopochtli, and also finalizing details of the new regime. And the new Quetzalcoatl will enjoy something more of a grace period himself, time to learn his persona and powers, without having to be thrown directly into a steaming cauldron. I salute you, by the way, Dr. Singh. Like your friends, you performed admirably.
Lakesh nodded and smiled.
Thank you very much, Lord Tezcatlipoca. That's very gracious of you. And yet, I wonder, are we being perhaps a trifle hasty in this desire to return to our former selves?
With all due respect to the Sun God and his pals, the sooner I have my head to myself, the better.
Kane speaks for me. Chalchihuitlicue isn't quite as ferocious as Tonatia, but there's plenty about her I find unsettling, and the thought of spending even another second in one of those hybrid bloodbaths. I'm sorry, Teresa. Makes my skin crawl.
You need not apologize to me. I am what I am.
You are a very intelligent and brave young woman.
Lakesh stood.
I can certainly understand how you feel, dearest Brigid. And the estimable Kane as well. I myself most assuredly share your distaste for the methods required to sustain us in our present elevated level of existence. But perhaps my duty lies in continuing to sacrifice my qualms in the interests of the great cause we all serve. There is much to be learned as the feathered serpent, and certainly with his powers I can do much to bring our goals closer within reach.
Kane and Brigid were both staring at him.
We're not going back to Cerberus without you, Lakesh. I thought we all agreed on that.
Well, to be sure. Yet you, young people, are so eager to relinquish your powers. That is, resume your normal lives. Perhaps you can precede me back while I stay on.
You need to let go, Lakesh.
All of us go together, or none of us goes. And as it happens, we're all going.
What Kane and Brigid are too tactful to tell you, Lakesh, but I'm not, is no way do we leave you the only god in the bunch. That's just not going to happen.
Lakesh sat back down. He looked to Domi, who was just polishing off a turkey leg, bones and all.
Domi, darling one, you are less, how shall I say, oppressed by the burden you bear than the others. Surely you understand. Surely you can explain to them how I feel.
She smiled at him, licked her fingers, and wiped them on her white smock. Then she stood and came toward him, moving with the sinister feline grace of Itzapapalotl.
I like being a goddess. I like being the obsidian butterfly. We've got a lot in common, you know. You do know. The blood stuff doesn't bother me the way it does Kane and Brigid. The urges don't bother me.
Lakesh turned his head this way and that as she stalked behind his chair, trying to follow her with his eyes. She got right behind him, leaned over him.
I like this, but if I do too much of it, it'll take me over, and I won't let that happen.
She reached around, hooked a taloned forefinger under his chin, and lifted his face toward hers.
Like Brigid said, like we all say, let it go. You haven't really got a choice.
For a moment, Lakesh looked as if he would get angry. Kane saw the skin beneath his chin dimple at a sudden increase of pressure from the needle-like claw tip.
Oh, very well. I cannot afford to stay away from Cerberus too long, in any event.
The five of them stood together in the Cerberus Control Center, staring at a large vid display. It showed real-time overhead imaging of Tenochtitlan, partially obscured by a broken overcast.
Doesn't seem real, does it?
You don't know the half of it. You were never a god.
Nope. Just good old Grant. And I'm damn glad.
Not that staying just good old Grant slowed you up much.
I wonder how Ernesto is going to adjust to the role of the plumed serpent.
I'm sure the Quetzalcoatl entity will bring him along gently and in due course.
Lakesh went to his favorite chair and sat. Then he swiveled to face the others.
Back there in the Institute, you all were practically threatening me to get me to relinquish Quetzalcoatl.
Yes, we were.
But surely you would never have done anything overt to me.
Why, Lakesh, I'm surprised at you. Haven't you learned better than to ask questions you don't really want to know the answers to?
Outlander's Sun Lord is a Graphic Audio production. Outlanders and all characters are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2004, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2005, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Azelford, Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Richard Rowan, Jeff Baker, Christopher Graybill, Michael Replogle, Kate Torrey, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terrence Azelford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Nathaniel Perry and Brian Rogers. Graphic audio sound design by Chris Rowan and Brian Rogers. The Outlander's theme was composed by Norman Vanderslice. Additional original music by Chris Rowan. If you enjoyed Outlanders, be sure to look for James Axler's Deathlands, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title. Outlanders number 30, Mask of the Sphinx. On a search for vital medical equipment, Kane, Grant, and DeFore stumble upon an old city that has modeled itself after ancient Egypt.
I am Nephrin, Queen of Aten. The oracles informed me that you'd come.
Yeah, but did you have to welcome us with an army?
While you are all here, I would like to introduce you to our other guest.
Erica Vance Sloan?
Well, hello there. What a pleasant surprise. The Imperator sends his regards.
I will hear the arguments of each side. To either join Sam the Imperator in his quest to unite the world, or to join you and your companions in resisting his efforts.
Your Highness, Erica Vance Sloan is here only as part of an attempt to incorporate one more city into Sam's fold.
Lakesh will spout only lies about the Imperator.
Sam wishes nothing more than the complete control of everything on this earth.
We can offer Aten untold power in exchange for your loyalties. What do they have to offer?
Freedom.
We're under attack!
Kane, you will join the so-called Imperial Mother to discover who is attempting to attack and sabotage this city.
What's my alternative?
The same fate that awaits us all if you do not succeed. Death.
I don't like this any more than you do, Erica. But let's just keep sharp and keep quiet.
You still sound like a mag.
You hear that?
Kane, what is it?
This cave. We need to get out of here.
Of all the evils that have plagued Western civilization, perhaps the most pernicious was the Nazi scourge of the 1930s and 40s. But Hitler's twisted philosophy didn't die with him in that bunker in Berlin.
Do you call yourself a white man?
Not your kind.
My kind is all there is, as you will soon see.
Mac Bolan teams up with Mossad agent Jacob Geller to prevent a would-be Führer and his minions from starting World War III.
I want Gerhard Steuben and the warhead. Have you got that?
What? I don't know what you're... Ah!
Who else wants to die for the half-assed master race? I want your Führer and the warhead.
Madman Gerhard Steuben's promise of a glorious Aryan nation takes malignant root among the disaffected white supremacists of post-apartheid South Africa.
Get me Pretoria. Their president has 4 hours to live.
Weizmann has a gun!
Bolan must finally pursue Steuben to the end of the earth, literally.
That Nazi bastard is going to explode a tactical nuclear device at the South Pole.
Not on my watch.
MacBolan Number 80, A Dying Evil, coming in December 2005 in graphic audio.
America is facing its darkest hour after a successful nuclear strike on Buklo, Texas. The madman responsible, Iraqi Razan Kariza, is moving forward with his plan to detonate three more nuclear devices with the aid of contacts within Russia, China, North Korea, and the Middle East. The only thing that stands between the world and Kariza's nuclear holocaust are the men and women of the president's ultra-clandestine force, Stony Man. But they're going to get more than they bargained for when they suddenly find themselves battling on another front as well. A conspiracy to overthrow the U.S. government, arising out of the very ranks dedicated to defending and protecting the homeland, the United States military. Stony Man Number 77, Full Blast.
The team is determined to find this bloody maniac and stop his clock one way or another. If you even suggest they back off, I don't like your chances. Now just come up with something we can work with.
Isn't it time you reconsidered your position, General?
No, it's time you shut your goddamn mouth, Mr. President, because you're finished!
I see the MiG coming in from your side for the kill.
Let's see if he fancies a game of chicken. Make your play, Sunshine.
Oh, shit!
No man can resist torture forever. In the end, you will tell your most secret things. You will betray all your friends and your country because it will be the only way to end your suffering. If I ask, you will even betray your mother and offer me your wife just so it will stop.
We move fast and we move hard. I want the top men of the Joint Military Command secured in detention. Then we deploy and we stand fast. The president has moved out of office, and I make my national broadcast. Because goddammit, the American public wants something done.
Stony Man Number 77, Full Blast, coming in December.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.